Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success.
Entree Architect membership has monthly training, unlimited access to business resources, a video library, and a private member forum with hundreds of entrepreneur architects just like you. Everything you need to build a better business is available now at Entree Architect. Subscribe today at entrearchitect.com/join. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. This is episode 279, and you may have heard about this week's guest. You may have even used his popular web-based tool to help research codes for your latest project. You may have even heard the news that his company is battling with the International Code Council for the legal right and privilege to use the content of the codes in association with his products and services. That's a very interesting story, and if you want to hear my interview with him about that battle, search it up over at the Entree Architect Community, our free private Facebook group, because we're not talking about that here. On this week's episode, how to take your concept for a product or service and build it into a successful new company with Scott Reynolds of UpCodes. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by our platform sponsors, Gusto, easy online payroll, benefits, and HR built for the modern small business. RCAT, the online resource delivering quality building material information, CAD details, BIM, specifications, and so much more. And FreshBooks, the cloud-based accounting software that makes running your small firm easy, fast, and secure. Spend less time on accounting and more time doing the work you love. Scott Reynolds, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, Mark.
You're welcome. This is going to be a good conversation. We had you on the Facebook group not too long ago in the Entree Architect community in the Facebook group, talking about your battle with the International Code Council and their lawsuit with you. But I'm not interested in that conversation here. I'm interested in UpCodes and how you built UpCodes and where you're planning on going with it. Before we get into that conversation, I want to introduce you. Scott Reynolds is a co-founder and CEO at UpCodes. UpCodes is software workflows to manage building code compliance, so it's a code software. Scott comes from a background in architecture, having worked several years in Hong Kong and New York City, focusing on international projects. So he's an architect. He leveraged his background in architecture to launch and scale a startup serving our industry, the AEC industry. Upcodes went through Y Combinator, which I'd love to talk about while we're talking about here, because that's something I'm interested in, and now serves over 200,000 monthly active users. So today we're going to talk about ideas. That's what we're basically going to focus on here. Ideas. And I said that you're an architect. You're not a licensed architect, right? You never.
That's correct. Right? Yeah, not a licensed architect.
Clarify that, because we get some of the listeners are touchy about that topic. And so, you know, went to Syracuse School of Architecture, graduated, worked in architecture, and then came along Upcodes and sort of took over your life. So before we get into that conversation about Upcodes and where it came from and how you're building it, let's start with your origin story. Let's start with where everything started. Let's talk about what, when did you discover your passion for what you do, and give us the origin story from that point to where you find yourself today.
Yeah, absolutely. It starts pretty early on in high school, in AP art. My teacher saw that I was pretty interested in art, but also structures, and made a lot of models and sculpture, and suggested I try out an architecture pre-summer college program. Happened to be Syracuse, where I'd end up going. And so I went to the program, just absolutely loved it, loved the design, loved the projects and the workflow. So applied to school, got into the architecture school at Syracuse, and did my undergrad there. And I absolutely loved it, loved the whole process, loved the creative problem solving, 3D problem solving. Would go on to graduate and went to Hong Kong, like you mentioned, and really got a first taste of what it's like to work in practice. And what is the difference between academia and practice? And I think there's a huge chasm or huge split between the two. In academia, it's very focused on design, at least in the school I was at. And in practice, you come to the realization there's a lot more real world parameters around these projects, whether it's budget or in this case building codes. And I just felt vastly underprepared for the reality of the practice, and a little bit frustrated in that. So I worked a couple of years in Hong Kong. I transferred over to New York City, so I got a taste for both international projects, but also domestic projects here in the U.S. And was pretty frustrated with that process of applying the building codes, understanding these regulations. It seemed like a very analog, manual process and very prone to errors. And I was looking around at other friends that had gone into other professions and had these interesting tools around them that they were using to make themselves more effective. And I said, hey, look, you know, wouldn't it be interesting if we could bring some of these interesting workflows or tools and new technology to architecture, and specifically building codes? So that was kind of the genesis, or what inspired the concept for Upcodes. And it was during that time I reached out to my brother Garrett, who at the time was working at PlanGrid, which is another construction-related startup, recently acquired by Autodesk. But this was many years ago. He was early on there. And I reached out to him. I said, hey, do you think we can apply technology to architecture, and in this case, building codes, to create a structured workflow around it? And that's really what kind of created the genesis of Upcodes.
So to talk about Upcodes, and what is it, and how do we use it? Because it's not just taking the building code and throwing it on the internet. The way we started before we had the internet, we had a bunch of books one big giant thick book on the shelf. And when you needed to apply the code, you read through the code and looked for the section you were looking for. Hopefully you found it. Hopefully it was up to date. You apply it to your drawings and you move on. And today the building code is getting bigger. You know, you have multiple volumes of building code. It's now available on the internet in different forms. And so what is Upcodes, and how are we using it?
Yeah. So just like you said, the world of building codes is only getting more complex. So every year there's more and more codes added. And I believe it's McKinsey. I think they said there's something like 90 some thousand different building codes throughout the US in terms of local municipalities. So it only gets more and more difficult to follow. And what we do is take as much of those regulations as we can and put it into one place, make it a little bit more searchable, build collaboration tools around that. So really, like you said, we put the codes online, but that's just the first step.
Right.
I think the real value comes from the workflow around it, the user interface, the user experience, So the ability to search, to hyperlink through, get previews for the hyperlinks, ability to bookmark, comment, and really create that workflow or collaboration that I think is essential to getting a new project out the door.
Yeah, and go ahead.
I was just going to add on to that. Then we introduced a second product and one that we're working on currently, Upcodes AI, which is taking that to the next logical step. So starting to automate or create a spell checker for compliance in BIM models, specifically Revit models. And I don't know if automate is the right word. It's more of a design aid. So just a kind of a tool in the architect's tool belt that they can use just as someone to look over their shoulder and catch potential code errors as they design, kind of like writing an email and getting a little underline under any potential misspelling of a word.
So like a spell checker. So if you're building a Revit model and you put in windows at a certain height, it's going to flag that as a potential code violation?
Right, exactly. Yeah. So we'll take the raw geometry, but also the metadata, so all that information behind BIM and what makes the BIM so valuable, and we'll mine that to look for potential code errors. So just like you said, like if a window is too tall, if a hallway is too narrow, a door too narrow, push bolt clearances aren't quite right, turning radius is in bathroom. So all these like what we consider low hanging fruit, but is actually pretty easy for us to look at a model and assess if this is compliant or not compliant.
And so you said you're working on that now. That's not yet available.
So we are working on it, and it is also available actually.
Okay.
We view it as a multi-year project. So a lot like self-driving cars, very, very difficult problem to solve. And I think is a multi-year endeavor. But for us, it's nice that we can actually release that product before it's at 100% completion.
Mm-hmm. So is it technically in a beta?
We actually just came out of beta a couple of weeks ago.
Okay.
Yeah. So we reached a 1.0. Where we were pretty comfortable with the limited set of checks we checked today. So we have about 50 checks, and they're getting more and more reliable as we go. But it is early days, and there's a huge long road ahead of us to keep building more and more intelligence into the system.
Yeah, very interesting. We've had Robert Yoon from Monograph is a friend of mine, and I know he's a friend of yours as well.
Right.
And we've had him on the podcast several times. And one was talking about Monograph and the process of getting that idea into fruition. And I want to talk about that with you as well of, you know, when you had that idea, that sort of spark, you're working in the industry, you're frustrated with this outdated process of building codes. You have this idea to turn it into software, you know, not necessarily build it into a big business or a big company, but you have a solution, a software solution. And so you reached out to your brother who had the technology experience. Not everybody has a brother who has technology experience, but that would probably be the next step, right? So what I wanted to talk about here in terms of this, the subject of our conversation is, how do you take that idea? Architects, I think, have ideas. We're very creative people. So we always are always having these ideas and how we can solve these bigger problems. How do we take that idea and take it to the next step and then the next step and then the next step and get it to the point where, you know, we might have a company like Upcodes?
Yeah, absolutely. So like you said, I was quite fortunate that my brother also had a technical background. So one of the big challenges will be for any architect to get a business off the ground, if it's tech related, is to find a partner or son that can actually implement that solution. So I think there's a couple ways to do it. One is, and I think the best way is to find an equal stake partner who will be the CTO and lead the technical side. Short of that, you can also hire, you can look abroad, you can look for affordable developers who can develop it. And really early days, you're just focusing on what we call an MVP or most viable product minimum viable product. And it's basically taking your concept and paring it down to the absolute most basic form of that, just to prove that this is something people need and people will use. So early days is all about proof of concept, getting a little bit of traction, getting some interest. And then you can use that to leverage and go find that technical partner. You can say, look, I've identified an issue. This is an interesting product we can bring to market. I've got a little bit of traction, and I think you should jump on board. So it's a nice way to get people on. It's also a great way to recruit even your first couple of employees. And ultimately, if you want to grow into a very big business and you want to go down the venture-backed route, which could or could not be a good decision depending on the company, but if that is where you want to go, that early traction is going to be critical to prove to the VCs that you're worth investing in and this could become a business.
So if you can take your idea and turn it into this minimal viable product on your own, you do that, and then with that idea and it's working at a very minimum level, then you go and find a technical partner?
Yeah, I think it could be done in a variety of formats, but that is probably the easiest. I think too often people start working and actually executing on their end product before they validate any of their assumptions. So thinking very abstractly, if you're an architect, you're probably going to be a product type of person, a domain expert, and the onus is going to be on you to validate the market and do a lot of the research. So that's better done upfront before you write any line of code. Mm-hmm. So I think it just naturally tends to work out that you as the architect will need to put that upfront investment in, do a lot of research, talk to a lot of users, put together mockups and plans of what this might look like before the technical side of your startup will write even a single line of code. Of course, if you know a technical person and you can get them on board right away, that's best case scenario. But next best is start in, get some proof, and then bring them in once you've done all that initial research.
If you don't know a technical person, and you said you can go abroad and find a developer and work with that way, or if you want to bring in a technical partner, how would you find that technical partner? You know, you're in San Francisco, you're sort of surrounded by technical people like that. But if we're on the East Coast or we're somewhere where we don't have that direct access at the coffee shop, bumping into developers, what do we do? How do we find that person?
So I think meetups are a great way. Hmm. So there's a lot of communities where a lot of like-minded folks are coming together, things like hackathons. So you'll find people in a very similar state or mental state that you're in. I think it can be a great way to find technical people. That's what I've heard to be the most successful if you don't have someone in your immediate network. Just getting out and meeting as many people as you can and meeting as many potential partners as possible. And I'll add on quickly, it helps to start that from day one before you, like ideally you've started that process before you actually need to bring a technical person on. So you've built out your community and you've built out your network. It just takes time to meet as many people as you can. And you want to be very selective. And you're going both ways. That person should be selective in who they work with. And you want to have very complementary skill sets. So you might have a really good friend who has maybe a technical expertise in certain sides, but might not be the best person for that particular product, for instance. So just having a larger network that you can draw on and you can have potential partnerships, I think goes quite a far way.
Right. And then so once you have a product that sort of works at a minimum level, you start testing it at a small level, right? Sort of just throw it out to your own community that you've built, see how it works, get some feedback, develop it, keep working on it. What kind of time investment is that? Because I think that's the thing that I think a lot of people aren't aware of, that if they want to sort of build this as a parallel business to their architecture firm, what type of time commitment are they going to need to commit to it? And is that realistic that you're going to do this and stay an architect?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think it probably boils down to the actual idea or the actual problem that's being solved. I think there are some products that can have minimal amount of time invested into it, but I think that's pretty unlikely. From what we've experienced and from what we've seen, most of these products take an enormous amount of time to get off the ground. So I wouldn't underestimate the amount of time it takes to launch these products. And actually a funny story from that, Upcodes was actually originally meant to be a side project. It was, I was in architecture And I was quite interested in the technology side and specifically the overlap between the two industries. And UpCodes was something I worked on late at night, all through the weekend to get this off the ground. And it was just like you said, it was a parallel project to my main job working as an architectural designer. And it started to get more and more traction to the point where we thought it was a proof of concept enough that it justified both of us leaving our respective jobs. So it was actually exactly the playbook that you described, doing it in parallel with your current job. And then once it has enough traction, committing to it and launching.
Yeah. Was that decision to leave architecture and pursue the technology company, was that a difficult decision for you?
It was pretty scary. Cause you know, as an architect, you have, I think a fairly clear career trajectory or you know, the steps you should go through and or at least I was thinking about my resume and how to build that out. And I think forefront of my thoughts was, you know, if I leave for a year or two, what will that look like on my resume? What would the impact be to, right, to my career trajectory as an architect? So it was a little bit scary, but definitely very exciting. I like learning new workflows and new ways to approach problems. And this was an opportunity to learn an entire new skill set and new tools. So it was both pretty scary, but also pretty interesting and exciting at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, and you didn't know what it would ultimately become. You only had an idea that there's this potential that it had. You've just gone through architecture school, which is not easy. You've invested a bunch of time and money into your career, and you get to a certain point where now you have to decide, am I going to pursue this or am I going to pursue that? Because UpCodes is going to be much bigger than something that you can handle and continue your career as an architect. So you had to decide one or the other. Architects are so invested as being architects and being identified as an architect that decision is more than just, you know, a financial decision or a career decision. It's an identity decision. Was that a difficult decision in terms of that, of the identity of saying, okay, I'm not going to be an architect. I'm going to be a CEO of a tech company.
Absolutely. I think anyone who does architecture from an early age or even from school has a very romantic idea of the architect, and then you get into that profession, and it is very hard to leave. And not, as you mentioned, I'm not a registered architect, but at least being involved in these architectural projects, I think it was very prestigious for myself, and I did really enjoy that. So you're absolutely right. That was another factor that makes it harder, or at least for myself, to leave and to jump into a tech product. And chances are you're going to fail. Most of these startups don't work out. So you take a leap of faith and you pray and you hope that it's going to work. I think it's a very real and justified fear when you take that launch.
Yeah. It's one of those things that, I think architects have a lot of, like I said, they have these ideas. They think they can turn them into something bigger and better. But when they get to that barrier of saying, okay, am I going to choose one or the other? That becomes a very difficult conversation. Like you said, architecture has this very defined path. The tech company has a very undefined path. And so it's difficult. We will be right back to our conversation after this quick break to say thank you to our platform sponsors here at Entree Architect, Gusto, Arcat, and FreshBooks. If you own a business or know someone who does, you probably know that us small firm business owners, we wear a lot of hats. And some of those hats are totally great, but some, like filing taxes and running payroll, not so great. That's where Gusto comes in. Gusto makes payroll, taxes, and HR actually easy for small businesses. Fast, simple payroll processing, benefits, and simple management tools all in one place. Gusto automatically pays and files your federal, state, and local taxes so you don't have to worry about it. Plus, they make it easy to add on health benefits and even 401ks for your team. Those old school clunky payroll providers just weren't built for the way modern small businesses work, but Gusto is. So let Gusto wear one of your many hats. You have better things to do. Listeners to the Entree Architect podcast get 3 months free when they run their first payroll. Try a demo and see for yourself at entrearchitect.com/gusto. That's entrearchitect.com/GUSTO. It's what every professional in architecture dreads. Editing down a manufacturer's specifications. Did that just make your skin crawl? Did that just make the hair on the back of your neck stand up? You're staring down a 54-page specification and you just need one product. Just one product and all of its attributes. That's all you need. There is a better way. And it's not throwing the entire specification into the project documents. That's a waste of time. That's a waste of money. It's RCAT.com's Spec Wizard. Spec Wizard is a unique tool that allows you to specify a product in minutes, not hours, by turning a specification into a simple-to-use website. Just select the products and options you want to specify and generate a three-part CSI specification in multiple formats. And best of all, it's free. And it requires no registration. You don't even need to send them your email address. It's all free, just like everything at RCAT. So go to entrearchitect.com/RCAT, entrearchitect.com/ARCAT, and try the better way of specifying products. RCAT's Spec Wizard. Do you remember when you started your small firm? It was no small feat. It took lots of late nights, early mornings, and maybe even the occasional all-nighter. Bottom line, you've been busy, insanely busy, ever since. So why not make things a little bit easier? Well, our friends at FreshBooks have the solution. FreshBooks invoicing and accounting software is designed specifically for small business owners. It's simple, intuitive, and it keeps you way more organized than the dusty shoebox filled with crumpled receipts. Create and send professional-looking invoices in 30 seconds and then get them paid 2 times faster with automated online payments. File expenses even quicker and keep them perfectly organized for tax time. And the best part, FreshBooks grows alongside your business, so you'll always have the tools that you need when you need them without ever having to learn the ins and outs of accounting. Join the 24 million people who've used FreshBooks. Try it for free for 30 days. That's free for 30 days. No catch, no credit card. Free. 30 days. Visit entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks. That's entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks. And enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section to get started. Gusto, RCAT, and FreshBooks. Please visit our platform sponsors today. And thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. So once you, for Upcoats, you got to that point where your brother and you had created this product. It's tested. It's working. Now you want to grow it, right? And so now you need to get some sort of financing. You're either going to have to put it out as a product and hopefully get some revenue so that you can reinvest it into the product. Or you're going to need some outside investment in order to do that a little bit quicker. And so what was your choice with Upcoats?
So we went down the road, or some people refer to it as the endless treadmill, but of going for VC funding, because we knew it would be a long project and one that would be hard to bootstrap. So you have, just to summarize, like you have the two ways you can bootstrap it. You can create revenue, and that revenue can sustain the business and help you grow organically. And there's a lot of very successful companies that have done so, like Basecamp, the project management software, has done that very well. And I think that's it. Some people look at VC-backed companies and think that's the kind of I don't really call it, but like they have the stamp of approval from these VC companies. But in reality, it's significantly harder and I think much more impressive if you can bootstrap the company. So that's one option, is bootstrapping. The other is getting outside investment, VC investment, angel investment, to bridge you between day one when you have zero revenue and when the company's profitable. So that's the route we chose, is going down the VC route. Like you mentioned before, we did end up going to Y Combinator, but early on we applied, I think the first time, didn't get in.
Explain what Y Combinator is for people who don't know.
So Y Combinator is a early company accelerator, or incubator. So they take, I think, around 100 or 120 companies twice a year, and for an intensive 3-4 month program, they inject a little bit of cash, and they give their advice, and they really kind of push them and create this pressure cooker of companies that will then go on to what's called demo day, when you kind of graduate from the program and you get up on stage and you pitch to a bunch of investors and try and collect investment money outside of Y Combinator. So it helps in a couple of ways. One is it is a good stamp of approval if you're going out for venture funding. But more importantly, I think that it gives you a very big community. So you can draw on not only the experts from Y Combinator, these kind of seasoned entrepreneurs who have gone out and done it themselves and can offer advice, but also your fellow founders in the program that you can tap on. You can get their insights and their feedback, but also kind of share in the ups and downs of inevitably any startup or starting any company.
Yeah. Are all those companies brought together physically? Are they in the same building or the same area?
Yeah, they are. So they have to be there present in Mountain View. So in the Bay Area, so near San Francisco. And there's multiple events a week, but you do work independently. So everyone has their own office space. Oftentimes it's just an apartment or a WeWork or some kind of shared office space. But multiple times a week, everyone gets together into the same room. You'll pitch to each other. You'll practice pitching. You'll hear other founders come in. Some of the alums like Dropbox, Drew Houston would come in and talk to us. Airbnb, the founders from there would come in and you could hear them. You could ask them questions, and they'll get experts in different domains to come in and either give talks or Q&As.
And then so you went through that program, and then what happened at the end of that program for you?
So for us, we ended the program and we were looking for seed capital. So we're going to do our first proper fundraise.
So up to that point, you were self-funded.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. So Y Combinator puts in some capital, but previous to Y Combinator putting in that initial capital, we had been self-funded.
Right. But even Y Combinator is only a few thousand dollars, right? It was like $10,000 or $20,000.
It used to be 20,000. It's actually much more significant now. I think it's 120,000. Okay.
But still not. It's still not $1 million. It's or $500,000. It's enough to sort of get the idea developed and executed.
Yeah, exactly. And the expense of hiring software engineers in the Bay Area is just enormous. So with that budget, it only gets you a couple months for a software engineer, which is just mind blowing, and really frustrating in many ways. So it's a whole lot of money, but it actually here it's hard to stretch that to go very, very far. We've always been as frugal as possible. We've only hired, I believe, one software engineer from Bay Area, but we actually, this is a whole nother topic, but we actually work as much as possible, as a remote team. So drawing talent from everywhere we can, that's a whole other topic, but happy to dive into that too. But yeah, I'll just mention quickly. So prior to Y Combinator, we were just going off of our funds that I had saved up working as an architect, and my brother from his previous job. So we were self-funded for many, many months. And then we got that initial funding from Y Combinator, graduated Y Combinator, and then raised a larger seed round afterwards.
And then what did you do with that larger seed round?
So then we went out and started to expand the team a little bit. Now, going back to what you said early on about the litigation with ICC, so actually kind of funny story here. We raised our seed round. We are in South Bay. I think it took around a month, and we were just doing multiple meetings a day, going out, pitching as many VCs as we could, taking as many meetings as we could, meeting angels. And we finally closed the round. We were absolutely exhausted from this Y Combinator program, followed by doing the raise. We were ready to go back home and collapse and go into a coma for a month. Right when we got home, there was a summons on our doorstep from ICC. So
I didn't realize the timing for that.
Yeah, it was.
So you didn't even have time to celebrate.
No, like literally not a minute. So unfortunately it was definitely challenging early on, because when we anticipated using this fundraise to build out the team and build out these products and ship these products quicker and faster and more of them, all of a sudden we're saying to ourselves, oh my gosh, like we're going to have to save a lot of this fundraise to defend ourselves in this litigation. If you don't have enough money to defend yourselves, you default lose. So, so a lot of that initial funding went to the lawsuit,
mm-hmm. which you're still fighting.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So we're about a year and a half into it.
If anybody wants to hear the details about the lawsuit, if you're in the Facebook group at entrearchitect.com/group, it's a private group, but any architects allowed in, that video is in there. Just search UpCodes and you'll find it in that Facebook group. We went deep into the lawsuit. That was the whole conversation was about that. So a couple of questions. That's very interesting with the timing. First couple of questions, and you can answer these or not, but how many investors did you end up having invest with you?
Yeah, so at that point, and what we call the, I think I mentioned it as a seed, but we actually consider it a pre-seed. Okay. So we've done two funding rounds to date. So we did a pre-seed and a seed. And that initial funding round, I believe we had around 10 or 12 investors, everyone from angels, so individuals, also friends and family, to medium-sized firms. So kind of in that lower or smaller half of the spectrum.
Was that still after Y Combinator?
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. So is at demo day.
And then what would you be willing to share how much you raised in that pre-seed?
Yeah, absolutely. So we raised, I think, 780,000.
Okay. And then how long between the pre-seed and then the second seed round or the seed round?
So I think it was around 8 or 12 months to the next round. Yeah, I believe 8 or 12 months.
And then are those new investors?
So it's a little bit of both. So a lot of our existing investors doubled down, mm-hmm. One tripled. So they, what's called like a follow-on investment, which is quite important for signaling. Yeah. So when you go out to new investors, you want to make sure that your current investors have put in a little bit more, because it means that they believe in you and the product's going well. So we got our existing investors to put in a little bit more, had good signaling, went out to external investors and raised a little bit more from external investors. And this time we went out and raised from some larger funds. So in that second round, we introduced larger VCs. So we had then on what's considered the cap table, or basically everyone who's invested, spanned between friends and family, angels, all the way up to a larger VC.
And then how much did you raise in the second round?
We haven't disclosed that publicly.
Okay. So is that where you are now? When was that last round?
So that last round was towards the end of last year. So
2018?
I would say that's right.
Okay.
Yeah. So towards the end of 2018.
Okay.
Yep. Yeah,
and
exactly.
So where's the company now in terms of the idea and the development of it?
Yeah. So now we're starting to build out the team. What we wanted to do early on and hire and bring some of these experts in. So I'd say we're middle of the ground between being very, very conservative and being one of these companies that just hires and gets very bloated and increases burn with some of these raises. So we're probably in the middle, maybe leaning a bit more towards cautious. So we're slowly adding on and hiring more people and building out the team. Maintainer are two focuses, both on UpCodes Web, so the online database, and then also UpCodes AI, the automated spell check.
That's super interesting and very valuable information for anybody who wants to sort of go down the route. What was like the total time from, you know, deciding, okay, I'm going to do this full time to where you are now? How long has that been?
Yeah, great question. I think it's been just shy of 3 years.
Okay.
So it's been a while now. It's been an interesting road, and it It's been about 3 years, but it feels probably like 10 years with everything that's happened in that time.
And the company, it's still not guaranteed, right, that you'll succeed.
Right.
I mean, you've done great with the company. The company's growing. You have 200,000 monthly users on the site. It's going in the right direction, but there's no guarantee that it's going to continue. But you're moving along very, very well. And so it's exciting to hear your story and your journey. And so what's the next step? What's sort of the future of UpCodes? What are your, other than AI, it sounds like AI is sort of the next big thing that'll probably be the thing that grows much more than the first piece of it. But what's the future of UpCodes?
Yeah, so I guess what we consider the North Star, or where we'd like to get in the future, is starting to reduce the amount of time in permitting and when you go for plans review. So eliminating as much of that wait time as possible. So getting as much structure around the submission, but as well the review from the government bodies. So for us, the next step is building these relationships with the government where they can start to utilize some of this technology. They can say either the architect does a report, they run UpCodes AI on the building, and it says, you know, it's passed the ADA, it's passed these things in building codes, and it's documented it very well. It's created a report, and they can give that report to the government, and the government can start to expedite that process quicker than what we experience today. So I guess it's trying to tighten that loop and close that loop and get these projects approved quicker and quicker and more efficiently. And I'll add just very quickly, and bring some transparency to that process. We think it's kind of crazy that you would have a building application and you have no idea whether this is going to be approved or not approved and why. And also the variability in these AHJs or plan examiners who might interpret a certain code section a different way. And there's a lot of opaqueness around the process. And I think for us, if we can bring a structured tech product to this process, it should bring a lot more transparency. You as the architect should have a lot more confidence that application will be accepted. Or if not, you want to have a variance, or you want to argue a particular area of the code, you should be as well equipped as possible for that process.
A huge challenge. Yes. I mean, you're talking not only about technology, but you're talking about people, and you're talking about bureaucracies and tradition and the way it's always been, and stepping on a lot of toes and collaborating and bringing other people along with you, and so many moving pieces to that. But thank you for doing that as an architect. Thank you for doing that, because not only does it make my job easier as an architect, because I don't want to be searching building codes and making sure that I have, but I want my buildings to be safe and I want them to meet the code. I also want the cost to be brought down, because I think a lot of the construction costs, I'm a residential architect, and a lot of the cost in residential architecture are these multiple regulations that keep growing and keep growing and keep growing, that makes construction more expensive, makes the design process more expensive. If we can have technology that would allow us to expedite that process in a much more efficient way, and if it's even automated, that as we're developing it, it's actually being checked and made sure that it's going to happen. So when we do submit it, all they're doing is checking that the software says that it passes and we all agree and we move along, the cost will come down.
And that's exactly our hope as well.
Yeah. Very, very exciting. Scott, thank you very much for coming on here and telling us your story, sharing the journey that UpCodes has had. Hopefully, as you move along and grow and this prospers, I'd love to have you come back on and give us updates along the way.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me, Mark. It's great to share the story, and I would love to be back.
Yeah, great. I have that one final question that I want to ask you that I ask everybody. What's one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think and relating it back to some of our early day processes, was trying to identify areas that you can automate or that you can bring in a technology solution to help relieve some of the pressure from yourself, or that you can kick out of house. So you can do externally, and I think really leveraging those two things. So one is leveraging tech products that can reduce your time, but then also going to places like Upwork and getting people to help you out with that process. If you can send it abroad or you can send it to specialists elsewhere in the country, I think can help you focus on your core job and the things that you're really good at, and you can specialize more in certain areas. I know that's been tremendously helpful for us through the process.
And not only will it allow you to focus on the things that you're good at, you'll be happier because you'll be doing the things that you're good at.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Right.
All right, cool. So on the web, it's up.codes. If you want to find Upcodes, you can search Upcodes, you'll find them. But the website is up.codes. On Twitter, the company Twitter is Upcodes. They update you on all the things that are going over at Upcodes. Scott, this was a very valuable conversation. I appreciate you coming here and being so transparent and sharing your story with us here at Entree Architect Podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
If you like this episode, your friends might like it too. You can share this episode at entrearchitect.com/episode279. You can just pop that link into an email and send it off to your friends and let them know what's happening here at the Entree Architect Podcast. That's how we're growing. We're growing one referral after another. That's how we're doing it, one at a time. So entrearchitect.com/episode279 to share this episode with Scott Reynolds and of Upcodes with your friends. We'd love for you to do that. If you want to join the membership over at Entree Architect, it's got everything you need to build a successful business. We have monthly online training. We have an archive of over 50 training sessions with different experts. We have a full video library of additional videos. We have products and resources and all the different things that you need to build a better business, and a member forum on Slack with hundreds of architects just like you, ready to interact and to learn from one another and share with one another in a private member forum. So go check that out at entrearchitect.com/join and learn all about the Entree Architect membership. And if you are an entrepreneur architect, and you probably are if you run or own your own small firm, if you do, you're an Entree Architect. And I encourage you to build a better business so you can be a better architect. Love, learn, and share what you know. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds. Get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.